All right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the U.S. Institute of Peace. I am Abby Williams, Vice President of the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention here at the Institute. And it is timely to focus on foreign policy and the next U.S. administration, which is the theme of this panel's discussion this morning. The next U.S. administration will need to define its foreign policy goals and foreign policy commitments, and it will need to do so in a changed and changing international environment. And of course, the world we now face is far less manageable than in earlier periods. Militarily, the United States remains the foremost power, but globalization has diffused economic and technological power around the world. And of course, there is the question of how much and what kind of military strength is actually needed. And to borrow Kissinger's famous comment from the Cold War, what in God's name would constitute strategic superiority in today's world? And what would be strategic sufficiency in a world of rogue and failing states and suicidal terrorists? The new president will also face foreign policy burdens and challenges, including international terrorism, weapons proliferation, the challenge of weak and failing states, climate change, and global poverty. And how these issues will be addressed will have important implications for the United States and for the rest of the world. And what kind of instruments will be available to the new president to deal with these problems? What are the constraints on U.S. capacity to formulate and implement an effective and a coherent foreign policy? And will foreign policy change in any meaningful way? We have three panelists who are exceptionally well qualified to address these issues this morning. And I will introduce them in the just in the order in which they will speak on the panel. Helena Cobben is a veteran journalist who has written for the Christian Science Monitor, the Boston Review, and several other periodicals. She's the author of many books, most recently Re-engage! America and the World After Bush. And she's currently serving as a friend in Washington for the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Nicholas Vozdev is editor of the National Interest and a senior fellow of the Senior Fellow of Strategic Studies at the Nixon Center. He's a frequent commentator on U.S. foreign policy, Russian and Eurasian affairs, and is the author of six books. Nick received his doctorate from Oxford, where he studies as a Rhodes Scholar. And Dan Twining is on the foreign policy planning staff at the State Department. From 2001 to 2004, he served as foreign policy advisor to Senator John McCain and was his legislative aide for defense and foreign affairs from 1997 to 2000. He's also served on the staff of the U.S. Trade Representative. So each of the panelists will speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll open it up to the question and answer period. Helena, you have the floor.
Thank you, Abby, and thank you all for coming. Thanks to the U.S. Institute of Peace, which has been doing just wonderful work for, 25 years now under congressional mandate, trying to build up the country's capacity for peaceful resolution of conflict. I'm here, I've got a couple of colleagues from the Friends Committee on National Legislation, Maureen and Nick, who are there. Maureen has the nice dark hair, long dark hair. So if you want information about the book, they can give you some information afterwards. I'm going to talk quickly about three big consequences of the globalization that has occurred in the world under a U.S.-dominated world over the past decades, and what these consequences actually mean for the foreign policy and the strategic planning of the next administration. The first of these big consequences is that foreign wars are becoming increasingly unwinnable, not just for the United States, but also for other military powers. And we can look at the amazing military superiority that the United States had in Iraq and its inability to transform that into winning the political strategic goals, in addition to, obviously, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, but that wasn't enough to constitute a strategic victory in Iraq. I should maybe mention that I'm one of two Quakers who is a member of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and I've been in the IISS for 20-plus years at this point. So I do come at this with a point of view, and I also come at it as an analyst, having done strategic studies at the University of Maryland back in the day. But it's kind of interesting to me to see, for example, Israel's experience with its overwhelming military superiority in Lebanon in 2006. Again, incapable of translating that into the strategic victory, the rollback of Hezbollah power that they had sought. So what is going on? Something is going on. I'm saying that foreign wars are becoming unwinnable. I'm not sure if they are yet unwinnable, but it's sort of, as I would say, asymptotic to unwinnable. And the reason, I think there are two reasons for this. The first is the increasing transparency of the global information environment. It's not wholly transparent yet. But, for example, in the 19th century, when the British or French wanted to launch campaigns in, you know, distant portions of Asia or Africa, or when the U.S. cavalry was marching through the West, people back in the metropole really never even learned about the human costs of those campaigns. The Germans, for example, could wipe out, practically speaking, the Herero people. That was at the end of the 19th century, or maybe even at the beginning of the 20th century. And people back in Berlin didn't even learn about it for many weeks or months later, and then, you know, only a small elite number of people learned, and they didn't really care. And this is the other big development over recent decades, that the norm of human equality, the equality of all human persons, regardless of skin color, ethnicity, religion, political affiliation, that all of us are, as we Quakers say, you know, born with equally that of the divine in us. In secular terms, you know, people have the human rights norm of human equality, that it matters if the Hereros or the Navajos or, you know, some people who are other than us, if they are suffering and dying in large numbers, small numbers, if they are being squeezed economically. And that norm of human equality, obviously it was enshrined in the United Nations, whole body of instruments related to the United Nations, and crucially in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Both of them wonderful creations of post-war Washington. So, you know, it's a fine legacy that we need to understand has had consequences throughout the world, and consequences married to the transparency of the IT environment that make foreign wars much, much harder, if not impossible, to win at this point. And that brings me to the second big consequence of US-sponsored globalization. Back in the 1990s, the great German writer and analyst, also I should say a Swarthmore graduate, but you know, I shouldn't carry this Quakerism business too far, Josef Joffe, described the United States' role in the world as that of an Uber power. I love the word because it has this sort of Germanic weight to it. It's better than hyperpower, better than superpower. And, you know, he wrote quite in a nuanced way about the roots of U.S. power and the consequences of U.S. power. That was in the 1990s. But what's been happening since the 1990s, or what has become increasingly evident since the 1990s, is that the U.S. is no longer an Uber power. It appeared to be that with the collapse of Soviet power, And perhaps it had the potential. I'm not sure it ever really had the potential that we as a country ever had the potential for a new American century, as the project was aimed at. But I think that actually the political victory of the project for a new American century, of the neocons in this country, in seizing power in the country, brought forward the end of the new American century by approximately 93 years. If it had ever had a chance, which I don't think it ever did. And what's been happening here? If you look at the main elements of national power, and I do have a whole chapter on this in the book, I describe them as being military power, human resource power, economic power, and reputational or soft power. And I look at what has happened in the last 15 years at each of these levels. The United States still retains undoubtedly the number one position as a military power. In terms of spending, in terms of having 1.5 million service members under arms at any one time. I mean, you know, there is no power in the world anywhere close to the capability, the raw military capability of the U.S. military. In terms of human resource power, the EU with expansion has actually now has more, you know, scientists, technologists, a very well-educated population, better educated across the board than the U.S., though the U.S., you know, excels at some high-end research tasks. But the general level of education in the EU, across the EU, the old and the new members, is higher than it is in this country, and the numbers are bigger. India and China, of course, are graduating huge numbers of engineers and technologists, and many of them of increasingly advanced capabilities. So human resources, we no longer dominate in the way that we did. Economically, this war is very expensive, and it's been financed not through taxes, as all previous wars were, but through lending. As a result, China now owns, I think, more than $400 billion worth of U.S. T-bills. Japan owns more than $500 of U.S. T-bills. This has consequences. I grew up in England in the 1950s and 1960s when, you know, British power was disappearing around the world rather rapidly. And one of the key moments in that was when Eisenhower took the decision to just overnight stop the support of the pound and to undersell the pound in 1956 as his response to the British and French imperial overreach in Suez. And that effectively brought to an end, over the years that followed, the whole of the British military presence east of Suez and changed the strategic geography of that part of the world. Now, I'm not saying that the Japanese or Chinese are going to do the same to the dollar, but you know, we have to recognize that they and other foreign holders of our T-bills have accrued enormous power that make the whole world is so much more economically interdependent right around the world now than it ever has been before, and our stock has been going down in good part because of this war. Finally, on reputational or soft power, I don't need to rehearse the very disturbing figures of how disfavorably people around the world tend to look at the United States these days. Again, another consequence in a major way of the decision to invade Iraq and the way that invasion was and the subsequent occupation have been handled. You know, we could recall the headline in Le Monde on September the 12th of 2001 when they said, "Nous sommes toutes les Américaines." Nobody in Le Monde or elsewhere around the world is going to be running a headline like that for many years to come, I should imagine. And the damage to our reputational power is enormous. And remember what I said about the global IT environment. You know, the United States' soft power has become much more important. The ability of countries to win allies, keep allies, convince those who are doubting, to win the war of ideas, now is more important than the ability to bomb people into submission. That's kind of the short version of what I see as the root of Israel's failure in Lebanon in 2006 and the U.S. failure, in strategic failure in Iraq over the past 5.5 years. So soft power is more important. Raw military power on its own is less important. But that is the only dimension of national power in which the U.S. still retains the number one slot. So that means that we have a completely new international lineup, a new international map, if you like. I guess Richard Haass has a book called The U.S. in a Non-Polar World that I'm very interested in reading. I think the non-polar world really is the way that we need to look at this. Maybe a new form of multipolarity. It won't be a bipolarity. And that has huge consequences that will ripple down through the decades ahead. And the third big consequence of U.S.-sponsored globalization is actually the emergence of climate change as a core global issue, in the same way that nuclear weapons have been a defining global issue since 1945. Climate change now is that kind of an issue that, like nuclear weapons, has the possibility, if mishandled, to lead not only to the end of human life on Earth, but to the end of all life on Earth. It is truly a global challenge. And it's one where there are all kinds of national and sectoral sensibilities. It seems that China's annual emissions rate has now just started to exceed ours as the United States. But per capita, of course, the picture is very different. Per capita, we have four times as many capitas as China. No, they have four times as many as us. So, so their per capita emissions are roughly one fourth of ours. The EU and Japan, which are both blocks that enjoy very nice lifestyles, I would say for an average person, possibly even a better lifestyle than in this country. You know, they have a transit system that works. They have a health care system that works a lot better than ours. They manage this with an annual per capita emissions rate of half of what ours is. So we have a serious problem in this country, both, you know, because of what we're doing and because of what we owe to the other countries, if you like. What the Indians and Chinese say is that, look, you Americans and Europeans, for 150 years, you were pumping out these dreadful emissions into the atmosphere, poisoning it for the rest of us. And now when we try to get some economic development, you try and stop us from doing that. But we just want the same kind of quality of life that you have. Well, you know, evidently this is going to be a huge issue. George W. Bush could stand aside from the Kyoto Treaty. Clinton, I should add, never sent the Kyoto Treaty to the Senate for ratification, which I think was, it was a very dishonest way for him to negotiate. He and Gore negotiated very toughly in the Kyoto negotiations and got a lot of concessions from other powers. And then they didn't even take the resulting treaty to the Senate for ratification. There was not engagement in good faith in that negotiation. So we have these three big developments, these three big consequences, as I say, of U.S.-sponsored globalization. They have, obviously, great importance for what any new president can do. I want to note, a quick footnote, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs has done some good opinion polling and found that the American public, 75% of them, actually support a U.S. role in global affairs, which is one of shared leadership. The question that the Chicago Council poll asked was, what role do you see for the U.S. in, you know, world leadership? Do you see the U.S. as most appropriately playing a preeminent leadership role, a shared leadership role, or withdrawing from any aspiration to leadership, a sort of isolationist option? And 75% of the Americans polled opted for shared leadership. I think that's great news. I think it shows that people outside the Beltway are much more realistic than the people here inside the Beltway, who still have some of these notions of, the U.S. as the indispensable nation, or, you know, continued global leadership of the U.S. on a unilateral basis. That really trying to find out the context and the modalities of this shared leadership is the big challenge ahead. huge implications for policy. Obviously, a wholly new role for the UN, wholly new relationship needed between the US and the UN, and a strengthening of UN capabilities. And thank God, you know, that FDR and Truman actually founded the UN, so we have it, you know, at this time of rapid global shifting power, that there is a UN, there is, you know, imperfect. I'm looking at Abby because he used to work at the UN. But, you know, we all know the UN has many imperfections, but thank God that it's there and that we have it to help mediate and moderate these shifts rather than not having it. We need a wholly new concept of the definition of the concept of global responsibility. We need a wholly new definition of the concept of national interest. I write about this more in the book, but I would argue very strongly that national interest needs to be redefined from the traditional realist model where it's the defense of nations against foreign aggression, a territorial nation-state-based definition, to a citizen-based definition. And this is in line with the whole UN kind of concept of security, real security being human security, and it argues for a much more people-centered view of security rather than a nation-state centered. So, you know, for us as the US citizenry, that's really exciting to start to conceive of what a citizen-based definition of our national interest would look like and how that we would use that to build a new kind of relationship with the peoples of the rest of the world. So I will just end with my agenda for the first 100 days. You know, I'm hoping that whoever wins this election has wholly, you know, read and internalized everything that I've been writing in my book and totally agrees with it and wants to implement it. And so this is what he should do in the first 100 days. Three very simple steps. The first is to announce a date certain by which all U.S. troops will have withdrawn from Iraq and to invite the U.N. to convene the series of negotiations that will allow that to happen. Step two is to close Guantanamo if George Bush hasn't already closed it. I believe he's sincere in saying that he wants to close it before the end of his term, but it's a very hard thing to do, and if he hasn't, then the new president should give added impetus to the move to close Guantanamo with its evident implications for our soft power around the world and our ability to argue convincingly for human rights interests around the world. And thirdly, the new president should, and this one he doesn't even need to really do anything apart from make an announcement, and, well, do a few things diplomatically, is to announce that the U.S. will participate in good faith in the negotiations on the post-Kyoto climate rules, because Kyoto runs out in 2012 and those negotiations have already started. So there, I mean, that's all he has to do. Three steps, first 100 days, transform the whole way the world looks at the U.S. government and our relationship as citizens with our government and with the rest of the world. Thank you, Abby.
Well, thank you very much, Helena. You certainly got us off to a very good start. I'll now give the floor to Nick Bozdev, and Nick is going to look back to see what lessons can be drawn from the current administration's foreign policy with a view to helping us understand the way forward. So, Nick, floor is yours.
One of the things that's troubling me about the current presidential campaign, and it's from both candidates and their surrogates, is a sense that there's a reset button for U.S. foreign policy, that the Bush administration made mistakes, had problems, did things differently, but come January 20th, 2009, there's a magic reset button that is hit and either brings us back to 2000 or 1992 or some period where you can just simply say, well, we're going to start over from a position that we think is the one that the U.S. should have occupied. The problem is that the successes and mistakes of the current administration did not occur in a vacuum. They occurred against the backdrop of two trends. The first, and Helena has already mentioned this in detail, is the diffusion of power around the world. We now have 15 economies that have crossed the $1 trillion GDP mark. when in 1985 there were only two that had crossed the $1 trillion mark, the U.S. and Japan. And more countries are poised to do that, technology, all of these things that were laid out. And those things are real because what it has given countries is not simply their ability to oppose the United States, but to ignore the United States. It's possible for countries now that don't need to route their relationship with each other and with the world through the United States. All one has to do is look at capital markets to see where most of the new IPOs are going, not going to New York, because New York is not the only place in the world where you can access global capital markets. You can go to London, you can go to Hong Kong, increasingly you can go to Dubai and elsewhere. And so it's a world where the U.S. is still the leading power, but it is not necessarily needs to be the maid of honor at every wedding and the grave digger at every funeral for things to happen in the world. And other countries increasingly, if they do not feel that the United States is responsive to their interests, needs, and concerns, before they might have sulked. Now they can just simply bypass the U.S. and go elsewhere. So the idea that the U.S. may have to compete a bit in the future for the world's attention, I think, is going to be a difficult shift for people who have conceived of Washington as the only place in the world where all roads must come to an end. And the second thing is the reality is that what we might term the global South and East increasingly wants to revise the terms of the global order as they emerged in the 1990s. Russia is, of course, the most prominent in its desire to revise how the world turned out after 1989. But China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and others are also quite interested, not in overturning the global order, but they want to revise it. They want changes to be made. India and China are not going to accept, for example, a global order in energy that more or less takes 1974 as its snapshot to say, well, energy as it was being used in 1974 is the way in which we ought to be thinking about energy allocations in 2008. So that these are realities that the next administration, either Democrat or Republican, will have to face. And it is not simply enough to say, as the bumper stickers like to say, you know, January 20th, 2009, that somehow this is a magic date and afterwards it's all sweetness and light with the U.S. relationship with the rest of the world. Depending on who is elected, I think both presidents will get a honeymoon period from the rest of the world. There'll be this sense of let's see what happens on their first number of steps. But the idea that somehow there's going to be this fundamental shift that occurs in the world simply because there's a new president in the White House and a new team is a dangerous illusion and particularly dangerous for policymakers here to have that somehow the arrival of a new face at Pennsylvania Avenue changes these ongoing trends. And even if and when the Iraq War is ended, that also doesn't, I think, affect some of these long-term trends. The Bush administration has a long list of mistakes. They have been examined in a great deal of detail in a variety of fora and appearances. And because of that, I think there is a tendency sometimes to miss out on how the Bush administration, in its 8 years in office, has attempted to deal with some of these new realities. And for me, looking at two periods, the immediate post 9/11 period and the immediate period after the beginning of the second term of the administration, I think both contain some useful lessons and guides both in how to perhaps approach these issues, but also the pitfalls that any administration is going to face in reorienting U.S. foreign policy. Briefly, in the immediate period after 9/11, after the attack on the Pentagon and the Twin Towers, you had a sense that the way forward for the U.S. was to forge a concert of power with other major states and also with a good deal of mid-level powers, that the al-Qaeda attacks had demonstrated the ability of a non-state transnational network to inflict harm, that no single state contained sufficient capacity to deal with this threat, that it would require active cooperation from a variety of governments. There was also, I think, a realization at the time that compared to a failed state, bad government may not always be the worst option, that even a state, say, like the People's Republic of China, you could look at and list its many faults, human rights defects and the like, but that was the alternative to having a government, to have something what you had had in Afghanistan or Somalia, where the absence of government altogether, whether it was a democratic or non-democratic government, that perhaps it was important for governments and states to work together to pursue common ends, to pool resources, and to try to work for a common goal. The problem that you can have with the concert of power system is, from the U.S. perspective, which has always been an issue and continues to be an issue, is the question of other states freeloading off of the activities of the U.S. So that this is an irritant that the U.S. has with other states, which is who's doing the heavy lifting, who's doing the work, and are other states pulling their quote-unquote fair share. But from the U.S. side, a concert of powers system works only to the extent that you are prepared to accept more or less the status quo in the world as it is. You cannot pursue a concert of powers approach with other major powers if at the same time you are also hoping to unleash fundamental transformation inside of those powers, particularly if that fundamental transformation has as its end goal the replacement of current governments with new governments. You cannot sort of say we want to have a close working relationship with a government, counterterrorism, nuclear proliferation, a variety of issues. Oh, but by the way, if we can replace your government with someone else, we'll also be doing that on the side, and we'll just compartmentalize this relationship. So you give us help on security, and at the same time, we're going to perhaps be interested in change of regime. If you look at the 19th century model of concert of power in Europe as it played out, it is a very cold, pragmatic, horse-trading, swapping approach to international affairs. It's diplomats meeting in closed rooms and redrawing borders and the like. There's not a lot of room. It's certainly not a citizens-based approach to world affairs. It is one that is grounded in states. It's grounded in dealings between governments and works on a good deal of quid pro quos. And I think that it's difficult, as people have studied, it's difficult for the U.S. to pursue this kind of foreign policy. It's difficult to get this policy sold here, both to the executive branch, to Congress, to key constituencies, because it seems, well, it used to be that it was seen as being too European. Perhaps now in the 21st century it'll be seen as being too Asian. But the idea that you have a kind of, we're going to work basically with status quo governments around the world to pursue common ends is difficult when you have a sense here that perhaps the status quo is not what the U.S. would prefer to see in some of these areas. You saw this difficulty in the idea immediately after 9/11 that terrorism was terrorism, no matter who practiced it, no matter the justness of the cause, no matter whether or not a group was oppressed or not, that terrorism had to be dealt with. And it's difficult, not only for the United States for that matter, but for many countries to sign on to that fully, because everyone had their list of groups that they wanted to see exempted or were not prepared to describe as terrorist. This concert approach, which could work only to the extent that in the months after 9/11 that people had a profound and palpable fear that more attacks were on the way, on the one hand, we didn't have a repeat of the attacks in the United States, and I think we're all grateful. But on the other hand, as months went by, the impetus for this kind of concert of powers approach, and you could really see it if you go back to some of the meetings held in Washington in September and October of 2001, and you're going to see this sense of urgency, and we have to work with powers. We have to open up to Iran and Syria. We have to do better with the Chinese. We got the FBI office in Beijing open to deal with counterterrorism, and there was the sense of governments are going to be working together, and suddenly by mid-2002, you start to have second thoughts, and, well, is it really this urgent? And then really by the end of 2002, beginning of 2003, particularly once the United States had made the determination that Iraq was going to be part of the war on terror, and other key coalition partners in the global war on terrorism decided not to, that you really began to see the fraying of that approach. It does raise cautionary warnings for either Senator Obama or Senator McCain, because at times in their rhetoric they have used this concert of powers approach in their speeches, talking about dealing with nuclear nonproliferation, talking about terrorism, and so it's useful perhaps to then argue whether or not they would be prepared to use political capital that they had to argue why, for example, you might have to override different legitimate U.S. concerns about another country's behavior if you thought it was going to bring concrete results in dealing with terrorism or nuclear nonproliferation. The Bush administration went only so far in the amount of political capital it was willing to use in that regard. And so it'll be a test for both Senators Obama and McCain that if they're talking about this outreach, particularly, say, to China and Russia, what extent to which they would be willing to do that. And the experience of the Bush administration in that is that it's problematic, and you'd have to be willing to risk political capital here at home. The second period that I am interested in looking at is what happened in the immediate year or so after the second inauguration. This was the year that the Secretary of State said we were going to rebuild alliances, we were going to reconnect with partners. Unlike the post 9/11 approach, the emphasis here was not on a concert of powers as much as it was to rebuild and to create alliances with potentially new partners with whom the values gap would not be a major issue. This was, of course, a problem with the concert of powers approach, which was how do you pursue common policies if you have a serious gap in values with some of your partners. 2005, the sense was, well, let's concentrate on rebuilding our ties with key European allies. Let's reach out to new power, to potentially new allies like India, sense that where there would be more of a sense of shared values, which could help minimize the shocks of the relationship, and where you could perhaps rebuild on existing patterns of cooperation. You had the tsunami relief effort in the Indian Ocean, which again was sort of seen as a harbinger of the United States, Japan, Australia, and India coming together to work to deliver supplies and provide security, in this sense that, well, perhaps if the U.S. could rebuild stronger ties at least with other democracies and with other allies, that this perhaps could be a way forward. And again, here I think the record has been mixed. Issues that we began to run up against was that in our relationships with key European partners, beginning with the EU3, but then working their way to other states in Europe, was a sense of whether or not the U.S. was prepared in the old, you know, Dan Rostenkowski formulation, you know, to get along, go along, and the sense that you had from the European partners was, well, we'll be more prepared to help the U.S., particularly as it is facing difficulties in Iraq, but we'd like to see more movement on climate change and on the Middle East peace process. And you had the sense that this was the swap that was being put forward, that this was the way to really rebuild the transatlantic relationship, and then Tony Blair's hosting of the 2005 G8 was supposed to really put a focus on these issues. Here, I think this is something, again, that both presidential candidates will have to squarely face, which is their willingness to deal with domestic U.S. lobbies that may have interests that conflict or run up against foreign policy priorities. In that, you know, the ability for the U.S. to move closer to the Europeans on some of these issues, again, runs up against the willingness of a president to expend political capital at home, explaining why certain policies will have to be undertaken. With India and then with some of the other southern democracies, a trend since 2005 that I find particularly troubling, and sorry, Dan, I'm going to have to point the finger firmly at the Congress on this one, is the sense of Congress still believing that agreements that are carefully negotiated between the United States and other powers, even other democracies, India, the free trade agreements with partners in Latin America and Asia, a lot of work goes into it. Diplomacy is give and take. And then if the attitude on the Hill is, well, this is the benevolence of the United States, who has nothing to gain from these agreements. The United States only loses when it signs deals with other countries. And so therefore we have to see these countries have to cough up more for these deals to go through. You know, one of the things, I know that there's a, you know, a legitimate and certainly very pronounced wave of differences on whether or not the U.S.-India civil nuclear deal is a good deal for the U.S., in theory. What I don't understand is people who say that they supported the deal and then decided, well, but I want to attach a bunch of other conditions to it. Because it's not as if the U.S. and India would be making this arrangement with each other and it's all India's benefit and the U.S. gains nothing. But the idea that, well, India needs to do other things, and these kind of, what I have to think of as I felt were somewhat insulting messages from the Congress to India about, well, if you want this deal with the U.S., we want you to do this with your foreign policy, and we want you to do this and that, with had nothing to do with the civil nuclear deal. And that's not surprisingly why the deal now sits in limbo in India, because both the left and the right in India say we're not going to give up our national sovereignty to please the United States. The trade deals with, you know, having, in this case, Senator Obama say, well, we want to renegotiate NAFTA, as if we didn't have a pretty protracted period of negotiations on that. You know, it just sends a signal to partners that the U.S. perhaps, you know, makes a deal and sort of has its hand behind its back with its fingers crossed. And it's not surprising, then, that other countries begin to be less willing to pony up or to be as supportive of the U.S. Interests. Let me just end on this last one, again, to be continue my bipartisan attack, as it were. You know, both in this last several months, both Senators Obama and McCain have talked a lot about multilateralism. We're going to listen to allies. We're not going to be, quote-unquote, unilateral. But when you had, in the run-up to the Bucharest summit for NATO, four major European allies, Germany, France, Italy, and Spain, expressing serious reservations about whether or not the alliance should expand at this time. I'm happy to be corrected if there is something in the documentary record that I missed. But, you know, Senators Obama and McCain supported the president's position, which was we should push for NATO expansion. I never saw a statement where they said, well, you know, we should consider that some of our allies have misgivings. We disagree with them, but, you know, they have a serious, legitimate reason, and, you know, we're going to demonstrate this new sense of multilateralism by taking those objections seriously. Instead, it was, well, NATO should expand, and we need to find a way to convince the Germans and the French and others why they need to go along with this. So my sense from looking at that is that, you know, you can say multilateralism, but, you know, if the idea is that multilateralism means other countries will accede to what you want and all you have to do is ask more nicely, I don't know that that's necessarily a recipe for success. NATO aside, I think where we're really going to see the rubber hitting the road on this, and every European analyst and politician I talk to says climate change will be the Iraq war of the next administration. You want to see the split in the transatlantic relationship that Iraq created, climate change will do that. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And I think this, is a case where the rhetoric on multilateralism from both of the candidates is good. It is welcome. But it's going to run up pretty quickly against some hard choices. And we'll have to see whether or not the successor to President Bush is as willing or not as willing to stake political capital to convince American interests and American constituencies why some actions will be needed that will be part of the U.S. re-engaging with the rest of the world.
Well, thank you very much, Nick, for another stimulating presentation. Of course, here in the U.S. Institute of Peace, we are particularly appreciative of bipartisan approaches and bipartisan criticisms or salutations. So we appreciate that approach. Let me give the floor now to Dan.
Thanks very much, Abby. I'm really happy to be here. I should just begin on a rather dull note by saying at Policy Planning, we sit around trading far-reaching and occasionally wacky ideas, which I hope I won't present too many wacky ideas to you today, but I'm certainly not a department spokesman or an administration spokesman, nor, because Abby mentioned my biography, nor am I a spokesman in any way for John McCain. On that front, let me try to frame this in terms of the way whoever comes to power in January is going to have to think about how to promote American interests and values in the world, and the challenges they're going to confront. I really like Nick's point about no reset button. I have Democratic friends associated with the Obama campaign who travel to Europe quite regularly and try to tell our European friends this, which is that you have to be careful if we win, we Democrats, they say, because we might then come and make asks of you that you might be expected to meet. So I'm hopefully going to make a pretty bipartisan presentation here, just for 10 minutes or so, about the challenges that the country faces, not the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or anyone else, but the country. And I guess I'd start with a point that I think both the previous panelists made, which is that although there's not going to be a reset button, the next president is going to, because of the symbolism of the transition of power and the way that the world agenda has evolved since the 1999-2000 campaign, whoever comes to office, I think, is going to get a bounce in global public opinion simply by virtue of being a different leader and coming in with a different style and background. I also think the agenda for day one for both candidates, whoever moves into the Oval Office, is actually strikingly similar for all the interest in Washington in promoting polarizing partisan differences. And it's going to be to close Guantanamo if it's not already closed. It's going to be to come to a pretty rapid consensus with the American public and our European allies and Japan and other countries in particular on climate change, where actually the candidates hold quite common positions. And one of them, my former boss, actually has a record of leadership. Guantanamo climate change, and then maybe the third would just be this idea that if you look at public opinion polling in America, what's fascinating is how much Americans like to be liked, and my wife is European and always comments on this. What public opinion polling shows is that a kind of overwhelming priority of the American people is to restore America's moral credibility and leadership in the world. I actually think the Bush administration has made a start on that, but again, because of the symbolism of the transfer, whoever comes to office is going to be quite focused on that. So I think the agenda on day one is actually the same. That said, let me just run through a few thoughts about maybe taking on this conventional wisdom of a multipolar world and new challengers to American leadership or the failures of American leadership. I spent a lot of time in Asia in particular, in the big Asian countries, the rising Asian countries, and also smaller countries in Southeast Asia. I also work occasionally on the Middle East. And one thing we find is that in regions of the world where there are security challenges, like Asia and like the Middle East, friends and allies don't want the next U.S. president to go on a worldwide apology tour. What they want is strength and kind of a presence, a strong American presence and strong leadership. And we see this in the Middle East. It's quiet because of the nature of our allies in the Middle East. Friends and partners across the Middle East are terribly worried about the threat of Iranian power. And for all the commentariat here about the need to negotiate with Iran and this sort of thing, and I think we should actually think quite creatively about how to manage Iran, because we've not done a great job. What our friends tell us constantly, quietly, and I say this as a U.S. official, and they talk to us quietly, is we want to see you take a tough line and stand up to these guys. That's in the Middle East. In Asia, I'm just back from 2.5 weeks there, including in China, countries seem quite focused on greater American leadership in their region, not less. They want more America, not less. And I know that may surprise people in Washington. Small Southeast Asian states worry about their big neighbors. Close allies like Korea worry about their very big neighbors. countries like Japan and China really value their special relations with us. This is quite interesting. To the extent that there is this narrative that the future of the world or the international system is increasingly going to be centered on the Asia-Pacific, the Bush administration since 2001 has managed to improve relations with every great power in the region, China, Japan, Korea, India, Australia. The secretary gave a speech in which she mentioned this last week. This is an unusual phenomenon. It's actually never happened. Part of the reason why I think it's happening is that great powers, as they rise in Asia, in the same way that America rose to world power in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, actually look at the world in ways similar to us. As their horizons expand and as their aspirations to leadership expand, as they are socialized as great powers rather than middling powers or regional powers, we increasingly speak a common language. And countries like China in particular, it's fascinating for all the narrative, again, about kind of China's the future adversary. The Chinese have said consistently since 1972 that their most important bilateral relationship is with the United States, and they say that today, because it's only the United States that could possibly trump or thwart their rise. This is quite interesting in thinking about the agenda for the next administration, again, which is that in terms of the Asia-Pacific and the center of gravity, we're actually doing pretty well. Let me talk quickly about a few of the challenges. I think it's much more fun to talk about rising Asian powers than it is about difficulties in the Middle East and in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Again, I'd just like to reiterate this point about the Middle East, which is that our friends and partners want to see strength and focused leadership. They don't want to see weakness and retreat, which means they don't want to see a U.S. precipitous withdrawal from Iraq. We hear that again and again and again. The challenge of Iranian power is something that the next administration will have to grapple with from a very early stage. Iran is not 10 feet tall, and I'm actually rather confident in the capacity of the United States and our friends and partners, including the Europeans, who just yesterday imposed new financial sanctions on Tehran, that this is a manageable issue. The most dangerous part of the world, in my personal opinion, is the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. New administration in January 2009 will confront an opportunity in the form of a democratic government in Pakistan, assuming it's still there, that actually has the legitimacy and support of its people, unlike the military government of President Musharraf that the Bush administration inherited. The challenge is that there is a bit of a vacuum of leadership in Pakistan. There are terrible problems in terms of attacks into Afghanistan against NATO and Afghan forces by militants in the Pakistani tribal regions. This is a hard question. We grapple every day with how to solve this, and we know what the long-term answer is in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. We know that it's promoting governance and development and security. That's a 20-year game. The question is, how does the new team in January 2009 manage in the first month if a terrorist attack in the West occurs that was plotted, trained for, and executed out of that Afghanistan-Pakistan nexus? And it's a dangerous question. It's worth speculating on the answer. We know what we need to do in the long term in this region. It's hard. One thing that the new team will have to grapple with in that region and more broadly in the Middle East, in parts of Africa that are troubled and elsewhere, is the problem that the U.S. and our friends really haven't figured out how to promote governance. We've gotten pretty good about promoting democracy over the last 20 years or so. We've gotten pretty good about promoting free and fair elections and monitoring them and this sort of thing. Maybe I can use an analogy with the military, which is that we've actually gotten quite good since September 11th. It took a while, but we've gotten quite good at training and equipping foreign militaries. And actually, we were quite good at this before September 11th in terms of the mill-to-mill relationships that the U.S. has had with countries across the globe. It's an important element of U.S. power to have officer corps educated and trained by American officers, professional military officers. We need a civilian complement to that in terms of training administrators and lawyers and local level government officials. We're still struggling on this, and it's an important conceptual thing for us to wrestle with as we think about the next 8 years, whoever's in office in Washington. I doubt there are going to be two more wars in the Middle East. The Bush years, the time after 9/11 was actually historically quite unusual. But we're going to face these governance challenges, and again, it's a sort of 50-year game. We have to figure out how to invest smarter and better. One thing, again, that one notices talking to Asians about and our European friends, and that feeds into this narrative of U.S. decline or the rise of the rest, as Fareed Zakaria calls them, is how to do global governance. And we're confronted with challenges on climate change, on proliferation, on human rights in terrible places like Zimbabwe and Burma, where they're trampled. Challenges to the global commons and to sort of the idea of stable and peaceful governments that treat their people humanely as a public good for the region and the world. The big problem in terms of, again, thinking about what replaces a U.S.-dominated world, the answer isn't necessarily in the next 8 years that we're talking about here. It's not necessarily, as Nick mentioned, a global concert or that other countries that are rising fast step up and take on some of these challenges, sea lane security, leadership on climate change, this sort of thing. The big problem in the world that one confronts in government is that the U.S. is overburdened and other countries are tempted to free ride. Nick alluded to this. Mm-hmm. This is a real problem for us. We're all very focused on the India story and the Brazil story and how fast China's economy will catch up with ours. These countries are not playing a global role commensurate with their power and resources and capabilities and aspirations. I was in China last week. We saw Dai Bingguo, who's the foreign minister's boss, who's the top party official on foreign policy. And he made the point that the U.S. is going to have to bear a disproportionate share of the burden on managing these global commons for the next 20 years, which was quite troubling to all of us because we wanted to hear him say exactly the opposite. So, again, moving beyond the sort of bashing the Bush administration, promoting a multipolar world storyline and thinking, I think it's a bit harder, but thinking about what we actually do, there's a big question for the next team, which we grapple with now in the Bush administration, in terms of how to get other countries to step up to the plate. And I'm afraid it's not simply new rising powers in Asia. It includes our European friends. The European Union model is fantastic. It works in Europe. It's been, as Javier Solana likes to say, the most effective source of regime change in the international system. But that is not yet being translated into kind of European leadership on global governance issues. And I'm afraid we have a lot more work to do with our European friends beyond the symbolism of European support for tougher climate change conventions and things like this. Finally, let me just close by saying that the biggest challenges to American leadership in the international system over the next decade that we're talking about in terms of the next administration are not external. They're not functions of the international system. They're not functions of the war in Iraq or the rise of China or the financial crisis. The nature and scale and kind of American leadership we will see in the next administration is largely going to be determined by what the American people want America to be doing in the world. This is why the protectionist rhetoric in the campaign is somewhat disturbing. It's why the sort of some of the calls for precipitous withdrawal from Iraq are disturbing to me. The biggest impediment, and again, it was fascinating because it's the Chinese who tell us this as much as anybody, that America's role in the world is not going to be determined or threatened or undermined by other powers. It's primarily going to be determined by us and the choices we make. And this is encouraging in the sense that we have a lot more control over the choices we make than we do over China's future trajectory, for instance. But what it means is there's a pretty serious role for the next president in continuing to make the case for internationalism, continuing to make the case for why we should care about human rights and democracy in far-flung parts of the world, continuing to make the case for why Americans can't pretend that things like global warming doesn't exist, and spend our money and resources and diplomatic efforts on trying to solve some of these really big challenges. So I'm actually rather confident that we can do it. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Dan, for that excellent presentation. We've had a number of interesting points which the panelists have raised. And before opening it up to the question and answer period, let me just highlight a few of those to refresh our memories. Helena mentioned three critical points, that foreign wars are becoming unwinnable, that the United States is no longer a superpower, and of course the emergence of climate change as a core global issue, a point which I think all three speakers actually agreed with. And then Nick underlined the point that there is no magic reset button for U.S. foreign policy, and that the new administration will not be able to change fundamentally some ongoing long-term trends, and that the reality, the new administration will have to deal with the reality of the global South and East and the move to revise the global economic order. And he introduced a third point, which is absolutely critical, which is the nexus between what happens on the domestic level and foreign policy, a point which Dan took up in a different way. And Nick's point was that a new U.S. president would have to convince domestic constituencies as to why certain foreign policy actions are needed, why they're required, why they need to be taken. And then three points I just underlined from Dan, that the agenda which will face the new president will remain roughly the same as it is now, and as part of that agenda, a new president will have to deal with the challenge of restoring American credibility and reputation. A second point that our friends and partners in the Middle East and Asia want to see American strength and engagement, not American weakness and disengagement. And finally, a new president, new administration will have to cope with the challenge of how you get other countries, other regions to share the burdens of global leadership and global governance. So let me now open it up to questions. And if you could just give your name and institutional affiliation. And I think there is a mic on that side which might help us hear other questions. Someone, okay, if you could come to the mic.
Go. Thank you. John Park here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Out of all of your talks, one thing that I didn't hear was the spike in commodity prices, specifically food and oil. It seems that if you talk about the challenges of governance, going forward you have the trend line of, right now, speculators. They met in Jeddah. The various countries who are the major consumers of oil met in Jeddah. And the Saudis attributed the rising oil prices to speculators. But if you look at the trends going forward and the challenges to the administration, it seems that you have two effects in the world, everything that we are facing in terms of the spikes in prices. To give you an example of a canary in the mine shaft, one is if we're looking at the severe energy situation, in the United States we see it as a blessing because it's devoting more R&D investment to renewables and so forth. But in a place like China, coal liquefaction is coming online. Now, to give you a little bit of information about coal liquefaction very quickly, only two countries have done it in history, and that's Nazi Germany and South Africa during apartheid. And the reason why is they had no access to energy, hence they went through a very costly process of converting coal into oil. Now, if China is doing that right now in a situation where they have access to the Middle East and Africa and oil resources there, what does that say about the gains made in renewables but lost with CO2 emissions on the Chinese side? So going forward, I raise that question of the challenges of governance, where if you factor in human nature, it seems that the enormous hurdles that we face impact us in a way that it's not just about the United States, but in a depressing manner, U.S. response is no longer sufficient.
Okay. And we'll take a few of the questions and then ask the panelists to respond.
Yeah. Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. On wars being unwinnable,
the one really big exception to that that I see is Vietnam, because the North Vietnamese won it decisively. In 1975, they sent their army into South Vietnam, took it over, no guerrilla resistance, no nothing, they took it over. Even more impressively to my mind, a few years later, they sent their army into Cambodia, crushed the Khmer Rouge, totally. I'm puzzled, for all the talk about counterinsurgency, I have never seen a study about how the North Vietnamese defeated the Khmer Rouge so quickly and so decisively. But it seems to me if you're going to talk about foreign wars being unwinnable, you have to take that one into account. It's only 30 years ago.
Thank you. Barbara? No.
Hi, Barbara Slayton from the U.S. Institute of Peace. For Mr. Twining, is it?
Twining
yes. or Twining?
Twining.
I was interested to hear you say that the Iran issue was manageable and that Iran is not 10 feet tall. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit more about the strategy and how you see it playing out, given the concerns that the Israelis in particular have, that Iran is getting very, very close to nuclear capability. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is David Nikuradze. I represent Georgian television station in Washington, D.C. My question is about U.S. and Eastern European conflict relations. During the Bush presidency, the United States remained quite good relations with many Eastern European states. Among them is the Republic of Georgia, who has quite difficult relations with Moscow. And I know many people in Georgia think that there are some changes might appear in U.S.-Georgia relations if the Democrats will come to power. So I'd like to ask you, how do you see relations between the next year's administration and Georgia in the future? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think there was a specific question to Dan, so we could reverse the order. Dan, perhaps you could respond to the specific question. I know there's a question relating to Georgia, which I know Nick follows that part of the world very closely. Then you might want to respond to that in particular, or any other issue, and Helena would. You could come in and third.
Okay, yeah. Thanks. On Iran, I don't actually work on it sort of daily. Right. So I can't tell you any secrets or give you any insight. I think the sort of broader point, though, just in terms of trends, is that the region is deeply concerned. There's a suggestion that the Iranians are overreaching. They're being terribly aggressive in Lebanon and in Iraq in particular, just unusually aggressive. Not unusually aggressive, but... in danger of overreaching. And I don't know, again, if this is something that the Bush administration will resolve in its remaining time in office. However, it does seem that whoever comes in into the Oval Office in January 2009 will have this at the top of his agenda and may be willing to take a fresh look. And a fresh look could break either way. I mean, it could be, you know, the kind of unconditional negotiations that Senator Obama has called for. Or it could be, in some ways, a tougher policy if it's John McCain. But there's also an argument that there's a middle way, which is actually a fusion of different kind of hard and soft approaches, which could involve both carrots and sticks. And again, I'm not speaking from any deep knowledge base, but the broader point is that the Iran challenge should be manageable in the long term, and a big part of that is because I think people who follow Iran much more closely than I do believe that Iranian society is has a degree of civic association and is enough in flux, and there is a degree of discontent with the nature of Iranian foreign policy and the nature of Iranian leadership and the nature of the Iranian system that at the end of the day we can fall back and possibly have faith that Iranians will be interested in pursuing a different course over the long term.
Thank you. Nick?
Sure. To David's question, I mean, I don't think there's any real major differences between the two candidates when it comes to U.S. relations with the states of Eastern Europe. I think that there would be almost no difference between what the Bush administration has done to what you might see in a McCain or Obama administration. For Georgia in particular, I think there might be a bit more of a personal connection between President Saakashvili and a President McCain than there might be with the President Obama. but for the most part, and particularly as long as both campaigns and particularly in their foreign policy teams have the degree of apprehension about the course that Russia has been taking over the last several years, it's unlikely that you would see a reversal of U.S. policy towards Russia, certainly nothing that would return to the immediate post 9/11 attempts at rapprochement between Moscow and Washington. So I think that in that case, there's not really much that I think the states of Eastern Europe would have to concern about a major change. On the commodity prices question and all of that, I mean, what's fascinating about that is that it feeds into the fact that, you know, the more people around the world want a middle-class lifestyle, the more that puts pressure on commodities, and also that some of the commodities are becoming harder to find, more expensive to extract, and the like. So that raises the question about whether or not innovation in the West, the global North and West, will begin finding substitutes for some of these commodities in a way that would not prevent the South and East from being able to enjoy the benefits of what they see as the middle-class lifestyle. But on energy, I mean, this is interesting because in the end, and we're coming back to questions of trade-offs, you cannot have, if you look at it, and again, sorry to blame Congress, but since I'm in an anti-congressional mood right now.
I'm in the executive branch.
I know, but
stop looking at
me. Congress. So, you know, I'm watching these congressional various hearings and statements on energy and foreign policy. It's a series of propositions that are not sustainable. You cannot have as your thing, we're going to reduce climate change, not build nuclear plants, not allow other countries to have nuclear, keep Iranian natural gas out of world markets. Somewhere something's going to have to give. You're going to have to start making choices. One, if you essentially say that we're going to have to move more to nuclear, and then there's a proliferation risk that runs with that as more countries gain access to nuclear technology, there's a proliferation risk. Do you simply say we're not going to try to meet climate change targets, and that, you know, coal is going to be used more, and we're going to have to accept that there's more CO2 in the air? What you're not going to have, and what is not sustainable, is saying to other countries, but particularly to India and China, you get to live with 3-hour blackouts a day, and you get to live with energy disruptions because that's what the U.S. wants you to do. It's not a sustainable outcome. It's not sustainable for a Chinese government that requires economic growth to legitimate itself. It's certainly not sustainable in an Indian democracy that Indian voters are going to vote to penalize themselves. It also, I mean, just the reaction to the higher gas prices here also shows the difficulties that from several years ago that I was beginning to see with trying to build up a stronger global coalition against Iran, which was, my argument was that would the U.S. public accept higher gas prices if that was going to be the price for getting China firmly on board and get China out of oil and gas deals in Iran? And the reaction to $4 a gallon gas, which is not great but still cheaper than what you're paying in other parts of the world, is no. So, you know, then we run up against these relatively three anemic sanctions resolutions we've gotten through the UN. But I can't see that other countries are going to not keep their investments potentially going in Iranian energy, India also being one of them, if they don't feel that there is something that the U.S. is offering as an alternative. And one of them is that, again, the domestic pressure on politicians here to keep energy prices low reduces our leverage with other countries to be able to tell them why they should not have access to energy or not pursue certain energy outcomes. So sooner or later, you know, the chips are going to fall, as I've, you know, again heard from some Europeans that said, solve Iran by 2011 or we go in to get the gas. You haven't solved your problems with Tehran by then, we go in to get the gas because we need it. And if we're going to maintain these climate change things, we need nuclear, which, you know, Germany doesn't want to build, or we need natural gas, and we'll get that gas from you. And then that has a foreign policy because it means the ability of the U.S. to hold together a coalition to pressure Iran is running under not only a nuclear deadline, but is running now under an energy deadline. Mm-hmm. And countries are going to start dropping away from us on that for the same reason that politicians here want to sue OPEC. You know, politicians in other countries are going to be under pressure about why they should be taking part in a U.S. coalition against Iran if it means higher prices at the pump for them. So that's one of the benefits of the spreading of democracy, is that it's harder for other governments to repress the middle-class desires of their citizens. So,
Helena?
Which is kind of what I was saying when I was saying that the norm of the equality of all human persons is becoming more and more acknowledged and, let's hope, embodied in actual practice. I think the questioner was quite right to raise the issue of commodity price spikes as being, you know, a very immediate and as well as deep-rooted issue. I mean, there's all kinds of questions around the stewardship of the world economy, and commodity prices in both fuel and food are central to this. My understanding is that there is a degree of speculation, because this was from a conference call that I was on with George Soros when he was trying to explain how, you know, people don't want to invest in U.S. real estate anymore, and there's just a lot of kind of capital washing around the international system, so where does it go? It goes into commodities. So there is a degree of speculation going on both in food and in fuel, but there are real underlying shortages and supply and demand issues as well, not least, you know, this fact that however many hundred million Chinese now want to put meat on the table. You know, gosh, how shocking. How dare they, you know? the economic growth in general, which requires at present a lot of fossil fuels. I think this is one of the issues that we as a citizenry are going to have to deal with, wrestle with amongst ourselves. I have a whole chapter in the book on international economic issues, and one of the issues that I focus in on is farm subsidies in this country. Farm subsidies that not only have really contributed to wiping out small family agriculture in many low-income countries, which has exacerbated the present food crisis internationally because of the dumping of, you know, Archer Daniels, Midland, and U.S. congressionally subsidized low-income grains in third world countries. So that has wiped out their local agriculture. And now, to add insult to injury, we are actually subsidizing, you know, big ag in this country to use wonderful land, agricultural land and other inputs to produce fuel for our SUVs. You know, people in India or in Mozambique or Zimbabwe or places where they are highly dependent on affordable grains, for some reason don't see why the right of an American to put biofuel into her SUV should rule over, you know, their right to feed their family. So, I mean, I think we as Americans really need to look at this issue. We are not the only rich country that has this bad effect on global grain prices. The EU and Japan also subsidize their farmers, and in all cases, it's a politically, you know, because of the weight of Iowa in our political system, and the Japanese have the same phenomenon, you know, where they are massively subsidizing rice, and it goes completely against the idea of the World Trade Organization. The Brazilians have time and again won rulings from the WTO on U.S. subsidy for cotton, which has wiped out the cotton industry in many parts of the third world and caused horrendous suffering. So, we as citizenry really do need to look at these issues in ways and understand that we are connected to the rest of the world in so many different ways, including, you know, through this common threat to our survival now. How are we going to share the pain of some of these things that need to be done? I would like to say, though, that dealing with the climate change challenge is not only a matter of pain, it's also a matter of opportunity. And the Germans have shown this in a real way, but, you know, the influence of the Green Party in Germany, they have developed so many new technologies Now, of course, the Bush administration people say that just leave it to the market and the market will develop the green technologies. That's not what has happened in Germany. It's not what happened actually in Texas when George W. Bush was the governor of Texas. And he put in place a whole system of state regulations and incentives to develop wind power, as a result of which Texas is a national leader in wind power. So, you know, we do need the kind of the governmental and regulatory structure here in the United States to be able to really foster that innovation that we need to solve the climate change issue, the same kind of commitment that we had to, you know, the Manhattan Project or to building the interstate system in the 1950s. Now need to have that same kind of national commitment to building a nationwide rapid transit system, you know, bullet trains from here to LA. I think it would be just fabulous. Happen to be a train person myself. But, you know, that kind of innovation that we need our next government. I'm not expecting, you know, either President Obama or President McCain to announce that in the first 100 days, but I think they could announce it in the first 2 years. Just come back to the winnability of wars. I did say foreign wars, so I think from the point of view of the North Vietnamese, winning in South Vietnam wouldn't have been foreign to them. But then you're right, you know, in Cambodia, you're also right to note that it was 30 years ago, and I think the global information environment has changed so much. I mean, there are many, many, actually many examples in the last, you know, if you're going back to a 30-year time frame of wars that have been won. But I'm talking about now in the 21st century when we have this information environment that, you know, whose transparency has exploded. Maybe that's the wrong verb. That makes the wars much more unwinnable. I mean, I'm sure that, like, you know, when the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia and there was suffering and there was all kind of things, people back home in Ho Chi Minh City didn't really, you know, see what was happening or feel what was happening or feel empathy, and they were anyway stressed and traumatized for many years of their own war. I think what's happening in this century is distinctive and new in terms of the global information environment. I did want to come back on this Iran point. I'm sure that Dan is reporting accurately what he hears from U.S. government allies and friends in the Middle East. But I actually have worked a lot on Middle East issues, and I talk to people who are U.S. allies and friends in the Middle East, and I talk to people who are not U.S. allies and friends in the Middle East. And I think my general impression is, first of all, that many of the people who are U.S. allies and friends in the Middle East are only problematically representative of their citizenries, if that. Egypt, for example, is very problematically representative, President Mubarak. And then, you know, you look at actually what they are doing on the ground, and, you know, maybe they're telling Dan and his colleagues in the State Department that, you know, we want firmer action against Iran, but actually they're busy doing a lot of deals with Iran and, inviting Iran to the GCC summit, and Israel is talking to indirectly to Syria and indirectly to Hamas. And, you know, a lot of stuff is going on in the region quite oblivious to the expressed desires and policies of the U.S. government. So the U.S., I mean, Washington's ability to control that has eroded hugely at the same time that, you know, the people that are the U.S. friends and allies in the region, as I say, are not really representative of their publics. Allied to that question of how we deal with Iran or with any of these issues, I think we need to interrogate this question of who. You know, here at this table we say we have to do this, we have to do that. But there is a sort of self-referentiality to the way that Americans sometimes deal or talk or think about international affairs. Actually, you know, all of these issues that we have discussed here, whether it's Iran, whether it's terrorism, whether it's the commodity price spikes, they are threats and challenges that face all of humanity, not just Americans. So it doesn't have to be, you know, the United States that develops the policy for this or does that or leads on this. You know, let's talk to the government of China. Let's talk to the government of India. Let's talk to, you know, other governments and peoples around the world and see what ideas they have. It doesn't need to be an idea that's made in Washington.
Can I do a one-minute response?
Sure.
Thanks. On Iran, the main reason that I believe our friends and allies in the region are hedging is because they fear a precipitous change in American policy towards Iran starting next January. It has very little to do with the current policy, I do not believe. On the representativeness of Middle Eastern governments, I agree with you, which is why I'm surprised that in the one big Arab country that does have a representative government, you would support an American troop withdrawal that could help collapse the gains, the democratic gains Iraq has seen.
Right. Open up to the audience again.
My name is Bob Barry, and the institution I'm associated with, the British American Security Information Council, has been very active in promoting the vision of the so-called Gang of Four, Schultz, Kissinger, et al. We've been pretty successful in the UK because we have an endorsement in principle of the vision and of the steps needed to begin to move towards that goal. We haven't had very much success with this administration, but to my surprise and delight, both presidential candidates, both Senator McCain and Senator Obama, have endorsed the idea, and Senator McCain has even embraced it, I would say, more warmly than Obama. So my question is this a worthwhile priority for, not is it a worthwhile priority, is it a likely priority for foreign policy of a new administration? And a subsidiary question, if it becomes one for us, is it likely to be one that the Russians are likely to be willing to meet us halfway on, because Russia depends now more on nuclear weaponry than it has in the past? Thank you.
Hi, Suzanne Brundage, Center for Strategic and International Studies. It seems that one aspect of the current administration's foreign policy that's been at least moderately successful is its approach to global health. So while it's not as controversial, per se, as Iraq, China, it is a global challenge. And my question for the panel is, how do you see the next administration building upon or sustaining the leadership that the U.S. has taken on this issue, particularly in context of the whole host of global challenges it will face upon entering office and potential domestic opposition to the resource mobilization it would take to continue this effort? Thank you.
My name is John Boonstra with the Better World Campaign. I just have two quick questions. My first is, I'm interested what the panelists think of the idea floated by the McCain campaign, as well as some voices on the left, to support, or in my view, more likely try to supplant the UN with a League of Democracies or something to that effect. And my second question is, I was hoping to press Ms. Cobbin a little bit more on the idea that the increasing transparency of the global information environment has made wars unwinnable. I just want to raise the example of things from the Armenian genocide, which the New York Times was printing cover stories on frequently, to something like Darfur or any of these other conflicts where we know exactly what's happening and are still just as loath to get involved. And then on the question of the unwinnability of the war in Iraq, it seems that suggesting that the information that we have about the damage being done, the civilians who are dying, calling that responsible for the unwinnability of that conflict seems to somewhat disturbingly point the lens to the domestic front. That's just an idea. And I would contend that perhaps it's a change in the definition of winning the war. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Beth Tucky. I'm with Africa Faith and Justice Network. And I'd just be curious to hear what you all have to say about the future of U.S. relations with the African countries. And kind of beyond Darfur, I mean, I think we've heard the candidates speak on Darfur, and I mean, what exactly they intend to do is still somewhat nebulous. But I think, you know, Africa as a continent plagued with conflict and health issues and, I mean, a myriad of problems. And it's also an area of growing strategic interest for the United States. And, you know, the Bush administration's response has been to kind of create this Africa Command, you know, leading with our military power where we still are strong. And, you know, training and equipping African militaries. But I'd just be interested to hear what you have to say about, I mean, either of the candidates or how we can deal with African countries moving forward. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you. Helena, do you want to?
Oh, gosh, we got such a smorgasbord. Okay. Global nuclear disarmament. Whether it looks as though it might be adopted, was that the question, by either of the candidates if he is successful? As an aspiration, you know, the U.S. is already sort of committed to this under Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, is committed to engaging in good faith negotiations for a complete multilateral disarmament at all levels. And the question is what the readiness to actually operationalize that. I did go to a good discussion not long ago on whether it's actually a good thing to work on right away or whether you want to try to get bring down the levels of nuclear weapons beforehand. My preference is that this be opened up as an issue of highest priority by the next administration, because, you know, we've got the increased fears of proliferation, the increased fears of proliferation to non-state actors, the inability to control non-state actors. I think some of those fears are somewhat overdrawn. But, you know, there is a kernel of reason to be concerned, certainly. And if we're working with all the other powers around the world on these other issues, economic governance, climate change, why not work with them on nuclear weapons? I mean, why is nuclear weapons an issue that uniquely we would not cooperate with the other world powers on? Unless, you know, we have something as the U.S. citizenry and government to kind of be fearful of or to hide. We are the only government that is not committed to a no first use policy, and I think it's extremely doable and requestable as an ask from the next president and definitely in the campaigns as they're going around that we ask them to commit to a no first use policy, because I think that will really do a lot to change perceptions around the world of why the U.S. has a nuclear arsenal, as well as to de-escalate the tensions around Iran. So that's one thing I think we can and should ask. As to, you know, whether they will engage in the, what did Sam Nunn call it, the walk to the mountaintop or whatever of global nuclear disarmament. I don't expect them to do it right away, but we can keep up the pressure and ask them. League of Democracies, I think, because it's a partial and a sort of a very ideological construct, I think it's destructive of the kind of norms that we want to see universalized. It looks like an attempt to recreate at a global level the kind of divisions that kept Europe in thrall during the Cold War. I can understand the desire and, you know, drive to seek to bring the benefits of democracy and democratic decision-making to all the peoples of the world. To me, one of the underlying, there are two underlying principles, very important principles, that underlie the whole idea of democracy. One is that of human equality, the equality of all human persons regardless of, you know, skin color, education level, race, or whatever. And the other is a commitment to nonviolent resolution of differences and conflicts. And I think that latter aspect of democratic theory is often ignored completely in this country, as with the preposterous idea that you can deliver democracy to another people on the tip of, you know, advanced weaponry, which of course sends just completely the wrong lesson to everybody out there. You know, what is democracy? Democracy is delivered by weapons? No. Democracy is that I have a very serious disagreement with you, but we are committed to finding a way to resolve that in non-violent ways. And, you know, that is the core of democracy domestically and, I maintain, internationally as well. So that's why I'm concerned about this idea of the League of Democracies. I think if we want to spread the benefits of democracy, which include, you know, in terms of domestic practice and international practice, solving problems and differences in nonviolent ways, then, you know, we need to practice, we need to model the behavior and to encourage it through community building, through all kinds of different ways around the world, not through military conquest. I guess that sort of would underlie my approach to dealing with genocide issues in Darfur or the horrendous issues of crimes against humanity in places like Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, which are completely uncovered by the media in this country compared with Darfur, and where the level of human suffering is actually higher. Because I do a lot of human rights work, I don't like to compare levels of suffering. Like, if one person suffers, it's already bad enough. But, you know, there are such horrendous problems facing the peoples of sub-Saharan Africa. They need our support. They need our resources. They need our commitment. I agree that the Bush administration has done some excellent things on global health, but I think that we need to have a much better commitment to a full-spectrum approach to AIDS prevention, HIV/AIDS prevention, that is not ruling out condoms and you know, the sort of the abstinence stress and focus, I think, has been very, very damaging to the anti-HIV/AIDS campaign. We need to above all rebalance the international playing field at the level of agricultural products, as I mentioned earlier. That if you could just get, you know, I was in Mozambique, and people were talking about how many thousands of cotton farmers had been driven off their farms because of the collapse of the cotton industry. And you can, you know, and that underlies that kind of, you know, completely unfair economic dealing that we have imposed on those peoples, pushing people off their family farms, making for these huge urban conglomerations that you see throughout sub-Saharan Africa, and climate change, which is forcing people, you know, to take these very, very risky and horrible journeys across the water to the Canary Islands or to Yemen. I mean, if Africans are facing real risks to travel to Yemen for a decent life, Yemen being a very poor country, then how awful are things back home in Somalia that drive them to do that? So, you know, we really need to pay a lot of attention if we do believe that all these people have the essential quality of human equality with us. So that's how you define winning. It's a great question. Largely, in terms of Iraq, what would it mean to win? I think we need to have that discussion in this country, because what do we want to leave? What do we want to have in Iraq? Do we want to have a functioning national governance system? Do we want it necessarily to be in alliance with us? Do we want it necessarily to be not in alliance with Iran? Do we want it necessarily to be democratic? We've never had those kind of discussions. The administration has defined winning in the way that it wants to. At one point, winning was defined in terms of purple fingers. And then the purple fingers led to, you know, the entrenchment of these large sectarian parties in the country, which then, you know, fueled the internal suffering even more. So, yes, it's a very serious discussion. We need to have it, and let's hope we can have it soon.
Thank you. Nick?
Just briefly, on the nuclear disarmament, I mean, the real question is going to be, if the United States cuts its nuclear arsenal by 90%, is that what people want, or is it 100% and not a single weapon? Because I think you can get very deep cuts from the United States, from Russia. The question is not 90%, it's going to 100. And that's where you're going to, I think, find difficulties, in part because these are weapons of last resort. Russia is not going to give up every nuclear weapon because under some scenarios, that's what stops, if Russian relations between Beijing and Moscow sour, that's what stops a Chinese invasion of Russian territory in the end, is the nuclear firewall. I don't know about with India and Pakistan. I mean, I know that there's always this talk about, well, India and Pakistan only got nuclear weapons because the P5 didn't fulfill their NPT obligations to disarm. You know, I think they were pursuing those weapons. Whether or not Britain and France gave up nuclear weapons was probably not going to have a lot of influence on Islamabad and New Delhi. And finally, this is an unmentioned fact with that. As long as the United States has the kind of overwhelming conventional advantages that it has, there are going to be countries that will want a nuclear, maybe they don't want weapons, but they might want an infrastructure. Because the U.S. has demonstrated that in many, when is the, other than Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the United States has never needed to use its nuclear weapons. We have some pretty good conventional weapons that do a lot of damage and go after things. And so, I don't think, for example, Iran wants nuclear weapons because they think a nuclear bomb would go over Tehran from the U.S. It's that the U.S. conventional advantages against Iran would be so overwhelming that they want to have this. So my sense on this is, I think you could come up 90% of the mountain, but you're not going to get to the top. And then the question is, if a McCain or Obama administration were to take us most of the way up the mountain, it's going to be a question of perception. Is 90% cut is good, or you didn't get the whole enchilada? The question, just briefly on winning, as a historian, it's an interesting question because it used to be that winning meant you occupy the country and you kill the enemy leader. VE Day was not 1955 when a democratic Germany, West Germany, entered NATO. VE Day was Hitler's dead in his bunker and his army has been destroyed. So, again, it talks all about domestic constituencies and domestic perceptions that the U.S., which militarily won the war in Iraq, is now going to be perceived as either having lost or not having had an overwhelming victory because we made the condition of victory tied to a post-war outcome. And that, again, coming back to Dan's point, that's also largely going to be a domestic issue, whether or not people perceive Iraq as a success or failure is largely in the eye of the beholder here. On the global health question, I think this is, and it's an important reminder to any administration about why you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater with a new administration. We've had this tendency over past administrations. New administration comes in and everything that the old administration did is suspect or put onto the back burner. And so the global health initiatives, I think, are one that either Senator McCain or Senator Obama would be advised to keep. And also because Dan's points about promoting governance, these are long-term programs. They're not going to be one administration initiatives. And I think the more that we have this sense of continuity of programs that do not depend upon one president but are seen as being run year in and year out will be critical. On a League of Democracies, if people aren't already familiar with my position on that, but my sense on that is less from the ideological side, but the fact that we've already had two attempts at trying to put together coalitions of democracy. It's called the Community of Democracies, and it's called the Democracy Caucus at the UN. The problem is that not that democracies can't get together and can't talk, and if the League of Democracies is supposed to be a way for certain countries to get together to coordinate their positions or to talk back and forth, I think that's fine. I think the problem that you've had is people are oversold on this idea of League of Democracies will come together, supplant the UN, and will be this massive force of 100-plus countries to do things that the UN doesn't want to do. And that runs up against the fact that on every issue where the UN supposedly has not moved quickly enough, there was no impediment for groups of democracies to take action on their own. And, you know, my beef with Darfur is been, and particularly for the Europeans, and this comes back to Dan's point about burden sharing and the like, you know, it's easy to hide behind Beijing's veto power and say, well, we can't do anything because Beijing will veto something in the Security Council. Well, maybe the British should take down their investment site on Sudan that promotes greater, you know, all the wonderful investment opportunities that British firms that can enjoy in Sudan. You know, it's the Germans saying, oh, well, we can't intervene because there's no UN resolution, but we can keep trading. You know, we can't let this interfere with the making of money. And Japan, of course, takes 48% of Sudan's oil. At least that's the figure that I was told. I know I saw the – so I don't want to be quoted on that as an absolute authority, but I, my understanding that it may be Chinese firms that process it, but it ends up being used in Tokyo. So League of Democracies to me is less – I understand your concern, new Cold War dividing, but not even getting to that point. It's the fact that at this point you don't have a sense that it could perform the functions that pundits here say it would perform. And certainly not with the global southern democracies. And my last example on that is, look at the countries that have recognized Kosovo independence. This was, I was told last year, this was the classic League of Democracies. Russia will block it in the Security Council. Didn't even go to a vote in the Security Council, I'm told, because the British, I'm told, told the U.S., don't put it to a vote in the Security Council because you won't even get a majority of votes in the Security Council. It's not going to be a 14 vote for Kosovo and one Russian veto. It's going to be split on north-south lines. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Brazil, India, Indonesia, and others are more aligned with the Russian and Chinese position on this than with the European and American ones, I think, sort of shows you that the League of Democracies idea has a serious fault line already running through it. If it's, as the Senator McCain has sort of said in more recent terms, if this would be a consulting and coordinating body, I think that's a different story. But I think the idea of this league as a kind of global NATO, and not even when old NATO in Europe isn't even really, or at least President Sarkozy is not in favor of it. So, on Africa, one thing about Africa, I think, finally, and this again is a question of perceptions, what people think. I was recently up in New York and was talking with a business figure, and he says he's just surprised at how much U.S. is not really investing in Africa. He says the Chinese and Russians are everywhere. There's massive opportunities, new projects going on. And part of it, I think, is the perception when you mention Africa, particularly in Washington, people think problems, they think disease, they think genocide, and all these are issues. But, you know, as long as the attitude here is that Africa is a problem to be solved by the U.S. rather than a region of the world to be engaged, mm-hmm. As you would engage in Asia or Latin America, it does seem to you know, if you look at, you know, even what was it, the latest Council of Foreign Relations report on Africa. It was all, you know, essentially Africa is a humanitarian mm-hmm. question for the U.S. You know, we'll have to see. I mean, one of the things that I'm finding quite interesting in monitoring is what's going to happen. I know it's only with one African country in this case, but, you know, what happens with IBSA, with India, Brazil, mm-hmm. South Africa as a regional forum? And how that develops and whether or not you may have capacities building into it, including the most recent exercises that they had last month, which are sea lanes, piracy, anti-piracy, and things like that. You know, no coverage here in the U.S. on this. No, it's below the radar screen, and I think that's problematic because, you know, this is an area where you need a kind of engagement. And you know, finally, you know, with Africa as well, is that you know, we have this sense of, well, there's minerals and resources and the like, but this is an area where the government alone can't do it, and you know, if U.S. business and U.S. civil society isn't, you know, leading the way on this, then the government doesn't respond. You have no, what are the Africa constituencies on the Hill? It's anti-genocide, it's health. You don't have a constituency saying why Nigeria should have the same degree of importance in Washington's concerns as Saudi Arabia mm-hmm. or any others. So, you know, in this sense, it's, you know, you're not going to, unless you have a people here rethink what they think about mm-hmm. Africa as a place for the U.S. to be involved in, the agenda is driven in that way. And unfortunately, the agenda as it's currently set for U.S. Mm-hmm. ties to Africa is either military or it's humanitarian, and it's very easy for that to get pushed onto the back burner and not get the attention it should.
Okay. Well, Dan, you have the last word.
Sure. I've been left in the very dangerous position of standing between the audience and your lunch, so I'm going to be quite fast. League of Democracies. I'm glad Nick mentioned Kosovo, because it's a fine example of the shortcomings of the UN system. Many of us support the UN quite strongly, and we actually wish it worked a lot better, again, in terms of burden sharing and this sort of thing. Russia vetoed or threatened to veto any UN Security Council authorization for Kosovo for the military intervention in 1999, but you had a group of like-minded countries in the form of NATO who did it anyway. And as I recall, I mean, I may be wrong, but I think Kosovo is remembered as having quite a high degree of international legitimacy, despite the lack of Security Council sanction for it up front. The idea of a League of Democracies is also attractive to those of us, like the guy who asked the question, our friend who asked the question, who care about human rights abuses in Darfur, for instance, because the UN Security Council has not been able to issue meaningful resolutions under Chapter 7 enforcing intervention or sanctions on Sudan in Darfur. At the same time, there's a group of quite like-minded, mainly Western democracies, that I think if you had a forum or an institution for coordinating action, might be able to do something quite useful. You see hints of this here and there. On Iran, the US and the EU are quite broadly in alignment now. Again, in a way that the Chinese and Russians are not, in terms of preventing meaningful, tight sanctions and action at the Security Council. I think one problem with the League of Democracies is people have this idea that the U.S. would go around invading future Iraqs with it, which is sort of the opposite of, I think, the idea of a lot of its proponents, which is that, no, it would be a forum to coordinate democratic action on human rights, on foreign assistance, on democracy promotion. There's a lot of soft stuff on global health issues. There's a huge amount of overlap and waste in different countries' foreign aid programs, the Europeans, us, the Japanese, and others. And we all have national foreign aid budgets and national programs. I mean, I lived in India, and my wife's British, so I saw all of the micro-health programs that the British were working on, and then I'd go over to the American embassy, and I'd see all the micro-health projects that the Americans were working on. I'm sure the cost of the bureaucracy of administering those is about 50% of the outlay. So I think the idea of a League of Democracies is intended to actually bolster multilateralism by providing a new multilateral tool in cases where the Security Council can't act. And it's very perplexing to a lot of us that that it's precisely people who favor a greater multilateral role for America in the world and favor greater coordination with allies and friends who oppose this idea. It gets it quite backwards, actually. That said, I don't think it would supplant the UN. Both the Obama and the McCain campaigns have talked a lot about this. So you may see it happening in some form or other, but it would be a coordination mechanism, and it would be a way, again, to restore America's leadership in cooperation with its friends and allies. Thanks.
Well, it only remains for me to thank our panelists for extraordinarily useful session. All their presentations and comments have been informed, illuminating, and judicious, and I also commend them on the discipline which they've exercised. It's exactly noon according to the clock on the wall. So thank you very much indeed for coming.